do they still do the, I haven't got a program for a long time, they still do the player interviews in the program where they like ask them about their interests?
Yeah, their favourite meal, in the 80s it was always a Sunday lunch or a full English with a pint of lager.
There's this absolutely wonderful clip of, and it's quite famous, but of Aston Villa players in there talking about their favourite drinks. And it's, you know, it's things like, I quite like lemonade and things like that. There was also one, Steven Gerrard did some kind of, I don't know, it's like BBC Three, one of these talking head interviews where they ask him quick questions and they asked him what his favourite cheese was. And he paused for a moment, looked thoughtfully and then answered, melted cheese.
Programme out from the first match I attended, didn't I? It's amazing how little there is to do with Oxford United in it. Just this got syndicated articles about Sheffield United. There's a two-page spread on Brian Robson.
And who were we playing in that match?
Bristol Rovers, October the 21st, okay. 1981. There was a brilliant article on Super Skills written by Colin Benson, where he just goes on this massive rant about young kids not being taught football properly. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. In the midst of it, someone really important to the club died, and he's just like, just, you know, page 83, quick mention.
Throughout the 80s, throughout the glory years, from 83 to 88, Jim Hunt, the club secretary, used to have two pages. And there's one bit where he kind of ruminates about setting up a committee to make up songs for the fans to sing that replace the referee's a wicker and who the fucking hell are you? And he suggested something with humour that included the town and gown.
Oh my god!
I mean, we've been talking about the lack of atmosphere recently. Maybe it's worth trying to write that song. Get it onto the terraces now.
I mean, this is an opportunity to actually get some songs out there, right? So you know, like a handful of people listen to this podcast, so we could write some. I mean, I'm not gonna, from the back of the North Stand, I'm not gonna be starting any chants anytime soon, so I reckon we can get some songs written.
Yeah, you reckon?
Oxblocker branded terrace chanting. I reckon we can do that. Because that is one thing that I always find really irritating about football, you know, modern football, etc. Everybody sings the same songs. There's like maybe 10 songs, absolutely maximum, that just do the same cycle between both sets of fans all the time. And whenever a club tried to, like a fan base tried to do something that's slightly different, they get heckled and abused for, you know, like, what the effing hell was that? Like, we'd like, you know, whenever an opposition fan hears the Jim Smith Yellow Submarine song, you know, we often get barracked for that because it's different to what they're used to. Mm. And I just find that lack of originality really, really annoying.
But also, if you sing, like, if you just do, like, Come On You Yellows, you get barracked as well, I find, these days as well, because it's, I don't know, old-fashioned, I guess. But the trouble is, those are the songs everybody knows.
Yeah.
And if you want more people to join in, then it makes more sense to sing the songs that everybody knows.
I used to, when I was a kid, I genuinely thought that the supporters club, their purpose was that during the week that people, the supporters, would go to the club in order to learn the songs for Saturday.
I mean, it's always amazed me how chants actually start and how tens of thousands of Man United fans are suddenly singing a song to a John Denver track. You know, I mean, I just don't know how it begins. To be honest, I kind of zone out of them these days, and I turn several times a match and say, I don't know what they're chanting, but I really hate that one. It's something to do with everywhere we go, I think. It's like, oh, God, not again.
Yeah.
They're not supposed to sing that one at home. That one was, I think I'm right in saying that it was the Northern Ireland national side's supporters. They came up with that one, I think I'm right in saying. And it was whenever they go around. It's a song to sing when you're on the road. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't actually care enough to be saying the words that I'm saying, so we shouldn't sing that one at home. That's all I'm saying.
I have a similar feeling about you're only here because it's Oxford. Well, of course you are. Why else would they be here? That's fine to sing that away,
yeah,
but not at home.
I think you touched on it earlier. There was quite a lot of talk online, wasn't there, recently about negativity in the stands, negativity of chanting. And I was trying really just to put it in context of the current world that I don't understand. But it's always been there. It's to my memory, there's always been more anti-Swindon songs than pro-Oxford songs in most. I mean, maybe it's just me, I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's nothing new. It's not a generational thing. You know, Horton Out, I mean, his name is literally Brian Horton Out in Oxford, isn't it? So, you know, the negativity was kind of baked in. And I was at the Manor plenty of times when it was half empty and cold and there was booing and people were miserable. Negativity is part of it. No, it's not about making it a carnival every time. But the bit that really struck me was at Coventry, and I put this in the blog, which is we scored, obviously we conceded early and then we scored quickly afterwards. And the reaction, particularly of a couple of the people in front of me, was identical, which was to turn to the Coventry fans and tell them, you know, abuse them. There was no energy directed towards our team. And it struck me, as much as I think negativity is part of the game or part of the fan experience, I wish it was more directed towards our team rather than against the opposition. That's what it fundamentally comes down to, in my opinion.
There's loads of really exciting stuff happening on the football pitch.
Yeah.
Is it, why are you focused on what those guys are doing? Why don't you enjoy the football? And as you said, I appreciate that, yeah, some, you know, the interaction between sets of supporters is part of the experience and is part of the fun. But not at the expense of watching the football, surely, because that's ultimately what I pay my money for.
That's what we were saying after the Coventry match, isn't it? Surely enjoying a game of football is the bare minimum that you should want from a football match. But we had a similar at Coventry, though we were a bit nearer the front, weren't we? And there was this group of lads who were probably second or third row in. And Coventry scored, and they stood up, gave the wanker sign to the Coventry fans. We scored, they stood up, gave the wanker sign to the Coventry fans. Coventry scored, they stood up, gave the wanker sign to the Coventry fans. Coventry scored again, they stood up, gave the wanker sign to the Coventry fans, and then left. And that was it. They'd gone after 17 minutes. That was their afternoon.
What a shame. They had like three or four more opportunities to have done that.
I know.
Much better value out of the game. This is an English thing as well. Yeah, so in Germany, the fans behind the goals, the ultras, will cheer, sing, wave flags non-stop, whatever the scoreline. In Cologne, they had 800 fans turned up to a training session with flares, with songs, with flags, you name it. And this was a training session. And the idea is to motivate the team, and the team have to go and stand in front of them and kind of absorb it and all the rest of it. But, I mean, the difference in loyalty and the difference in this kind of steadfast support, regardless of how well or bad a team's doing, whether it be in one match or across the season, is just so incredibly different.
There's been a weird, I think, an anomaly this season. After Manning's departure, we had that Leyton Orient game where, I mean, the atmosphere at that Leyton Orient game was, broadly speaking, really, really good. It was a little bit of, I mean, it was, maybe it was charged by animosity towards Liam Manning, which helped kind of feed it and fuel it. But the atmosphere was really good. And the atmosphere at the end of the game was as good as I remember an atmosphere at an Oxford game in a really long time. It was wonderful. It was really kind of, you know, one of those togetherness moments that you get maybe one or two of a season if you're lucky. And that was incredible. And it was really, really, really positive. And I was really optimistic about what would then happen over the next few months. And then obviously we had Des Buchanan's appointment that everybody was really excited about. And then maybe the level of excitement about this guy, you know, the hero return and all of that kind of thing was set people's already high expectations even higher, because the strange kickback to what was essentially a slight wobble in our league results was really noteworthy in terms of the level of animosity that was directed suddenly at the players and the manager. And we've all experienced those games that are a bit miserable and a bit rubbish and a bit kind of, you know, disappointing in terms of atmosphere and stuff like that. And those negative ones as well. But to go from such a positive to this real, almost kind of like level of extreme spite from a very small number of people, admittedly, but a noticeable number of people, was really, really weird. And I don't really know how to explain why some people, a small number of people, turned so aggressively.
So that sort of level of toxicity is not new, because that was around last season as well. And I wonder if that's the same group of people who, for whatever reason, just feel the need to be like that. I don't know why you would enjoy bringing that to the club, but it's not a new thing.
Well, it feels to me like it's a habit thing. We're on a hair trigger. The whole Buckingham arrival created this great story, this returning hero, Manning plus a personality. It's not an upgrade. And when that didn't quite materialise instantaneously, you know, there was this sort of collective folding of the arms and, come on, impress us, you know, perform for us. And the club is at its best, and any football club is at its best, when it is together for something. Even when if it's fighting relegation or it's fighting for promotion or anything like that, that's when it's at its best. And I don't know exactly what's driven it. I suspect there's a little bit around we've just been in this league for too long, and there's a kind of feeling like, right, we're bored now, get us out. I suspect if the first season that we were back in League One, obviously there was the benefits of promotion and all that kind of stuff, but there was a sort of it was an us against the division mentality that galvanised everybody. And then that kind of, people start putting effort in, not just in attitude, but then things like the ultras really up their game, you know, throughout that season, which generates a better atmosphere. And I just think we are in this kind of slightly expectant, complacent, build me a stadium, get me out of League One, sign me a 20 goal a season striker kind of attitude at the moment. Collectively, it's not pointing fingers at any individual. It's a kind of collective malaise that we need to kind of work our way out of.
Maybe there's we don't quite have the match day activations that Tim Williams thinks we do.
or maybe we've got too many match day activations.
Maybe.
Is that it? It's like overstimulation. They're just going to have to sort of, you know, drug Ollie the Ox just to slow him down, just bring the tempo down.
That's the half-time entertainment I'd like to see.
I'm not sure I'd want to sort of be at a match watching Ollie the Ox on drugs myself. That could be quite an experience.
I'd like to do that while performing as Ollie the Ox. I've got to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of a Bez-style mascot. Yeah, that'd be great.
Just to completely change the subject ever so briefly, I want to tell my Ollie the Ox story. And I don't know who it was who was the Ollie the Ox person inside the suit. And this is going back to the very early days of the Kassam Stadium. I used to kind of go in and stand at the front and then wait for the team to come up on the little scoreboard thing, because there was no internet back, mobile internet back then to know what the team was. And I'd stand there and Ollie the Ox would come round and he'd like chat to all the little kids and do the high fives and have a chat. And the kids would all kind of run up there and sit there with their little autograph books and be really excited. And he'd always see me because I was always stood there and we'd have a quick chat. And I absolutely loved it because he was sat there. He'd come over to me and go, "Well, so what do you reckon today then, mate? I don't think we got a fucking hope in hell's chance. This bunch of useless wankers haven't got a clue what they're..." And he sat there, Ollie the Ox turning the air blue as these tiny little children are there waiting for a high five and a bag of sweets.
It's basically like a bad Santa in football mascot form.
Do you think that the mascots are... I think that's quite a dated thing now. I'm surprised that they're still around. It just feels very kind of 90s. It doesn't feel like it belongs in modern football, the club mascots.
Yeah, it was a quite... I mean, I obviously, my favourite thing of modern football is when there was a period, and I think there was a Twitter account for this, but it was mascots observing a minute of silence. the mascot on the centre circle with the players with their head bowed. But that's funny and that's enjoyable, but it's not as funny as enjoyable as the... Is it Cyril the Swan?
Cyril the Swan.
Who got in a massive fight?
Oh no, that was the Wolves mascot.
Was it
that got in a fight? I think with the Bristol City mascot. But Cyril the Swan got flagged offside. he was running offside. And the linesman just saw the kit and flagged him offside.
Does your neck and beak count? Is that part of the torso?
can you legally score, I mean, it'd be
absolutely knackered week in, week out, wouldn't it? I mean, if that's...
I don't know that your beak is going to give you much of an advantage.
No,
is it?
No.
The whole crowd collectively screaming beak ball when it strikes him. Ball to beak. Ball to beak.
Yeah, his beak was in an unnatural position. Stuck out the side of its wing or something. It's no wonder no one knows the handball rule when you've got swans stuck in the mix as well.
I genuinely think that the ultras that period, we were the best in the sense of creating an atmosphere from almost nothing, the best supporters in the country. Not just the paper displays, the flag waving display against Swindon, where Maguire scored twice, was sensational. That TIFO was an EFL trophy game, I think. We're not talking about games of
math. I don't know what TIFO is.
It's a big flag thing.
Right, okay. As you were.
Genuinely took my breath away when it came out. It stopped me in my tracks. It was, and I get it's money and effort and that kind of stuff, but it really kind of shows what a difference it makes when that effort is put in place. You know,
it's really interesting actually, because obviously there was some contention around when the ultras decided they were gonna call it a day. I mean, I think broadly speaking, a lot of them have just got a bit old to be spending all of their time doing that kind of thing. And they obviously clearly made a conscious decision as well to stop starting the songs and stuff like that. And instantly the atmosphere at home stopped. I mean, it has never recovered from that. I do think personally it's a shame that they decided to stop singing as well as putting all of the effort into the flags, etc., and things like that. But you know, they've got their own reasons for that. But yeah, we haven't recovered from that. And of course, you know, we've had the issues around kind of COVID and the break that had.
I think COVID is probably actually quite a big deal, because I think it's not just football. I think generally going out, people can't be asked as much as they could beforehand. I don't know why it's changed so much, but I think it's actually that sort of reflects a lot of society, is just that people can't be bothered as much, speaking from experience. might also be middle age, admittedly.
Before we get off of the flag thing, and I don't know if you've all got your phones with you, but I'm going to send to the group a picture, because this was kind of pre-ultras, and it was when we first got our... I mean, actually, we'd had this flag for a while now, but we got the first big yellow flag with the ox head on it, which they used to pull down in front of the... over people's heads in the East Stand. This game was Chris Wilder's... It's Chris Wilder's... it's his 11th home game in charge. And it was a 2-1 win against Histon. We'll stick it out on social media and stuff. But it was the big yellow flag with the ox head unfurled over everybody's heads, and it's upside down. And I think that is probably the most oxygenated photograph that I have in my collection.
Love it.
Just superb.
On the subject of TIFOs, and sort of tying into what I was saying earlier about the Bundesliga, there is a lot to be said for how clubs with memberships made up of fans have a far more integrated approach to support in general and the culture of that club. But week in, week out, it's German ultras will make TIFOs of that nature. There's like pulley systems built into the stands so they can actually like raise them as the team come on the pitch. Absolutely incredible. You know, works of art, not just Germany, other countries as well, but not our country. And it's really, really noticeable just how different our fan culture is compared to continental Europe, I would say.
The thing that struck me at Coventry, I don't know why Coventry was such a kind of pivotal moment in that respect, is that the English fan culture is quite stuck. And I'd made the point in the blog about everybody looks like they're going to see Oasis in 94, and that was 30 years ago. And it sort of it's kind of like, where's the new influences coming from? And if you go back to that period, 2015 through to 2017, 2018, and the ultras, all of those innovations came from different places, different countries. You know, Tifo, even the term is Italian, isn't it? I think something like that. You know, flag culture isn't an English thing. Pyro's not an English thing. None of those things. The English football experience for the last, 45 years or something, is going and abusing the opposition. There's still the kind of remaining, we hate the opposition, rather than we're going to out support the opposition. The songs that we consider to be just the songs that everybody sang were innovative at one point, by whether it was the Northern Ireland fans or the Red Wall, the Welsh fans, some of the bigger clubs that have been around Europe and seen the, you know, experienced European football and kind of replicated it. We need to find ways of getting new ideas into the atmosphere of the club. And the other point, at risk of sort of hogging this, is the atmosphere is not just about shouting really loudly on the terraces. It's also about the whole experience of going to a game, from walking up to the stadium to eating the food to meeting your friends to...
I know where this is heading.
Where's this going?
Go on. Well, I think you're talking about matchday activations, aren't you, Scott? But that's 100% correct. How many times do we walk down that path from Greater Leeds, and even against a big club, there's no one anywhere near us, front or behind. And until you get really nearly right up to the east stand, you don't see another supporter. It's kind of weird. Hopefully the new stadium will address these things. But it's kind of strange, like how does this happen? Where does this come from? If in the 1980s, you know, the club were kind of naively trying to do their best by suggesting songs and you know, asking fans to practice songs, which just sounds convoluted. But actually, I think it is about the club and the fans working together. And when that did happen, when the ultras were allowed to do their thing, produced huge banners, you know, had permission to do that, it was a different time. And that was a good example of how coming together was just created just such a different atmosphere.
There's a weird thing as well, and this might just be because I've become more curmudgeonly and less tolerant as I've got older. I remember you speaking about the game in your blog. This is the Swansea FA Cup match, and I remember being quite cynical about that game because I'd remembered us beating Swansea 3-0 at the Kassam Stadium not that long ago in the league, and I was like, well, why should I get excited about them being a Premier League coming to the Kassam Stadium? Just getting to the ground, I mean, I was completely turned around on my view of that game, because there was, and I hate, you know, it's such a football journalist cliche to say there was a buzz around the ground, but there was this like really good atmosphere. And the atmosphere in that game was absolutely fantastic. And of course it helped because the surrounding stuff with that season being so good, and our performances being so good and our side being amazing and all of that kind of stuff. But I spoke to a guy at work the next day, and because he lived in Blackbird Leeds, and it was the first time he'd ever heard the crowd from his house. I kind of wind forward to now, and I can't see how anything has changed, but the two games against Man City and the game against Arsenal were just a gigantic arse ache. And that really might just be me. I didn't get that sense from any of those games of that level of excitement that seemed to be around the club for that Swansea game. That was really strange.
It might be. It was also, those were evening matches and everyone was struggling to get there straight from work. Another thing I was going to say about the atmosphere is I don't think that the way football is played these days is as exciting. I don't think that this sort of little short passing, it doesn't build the crowd up in the same way. The most exciting passage of play this season, I think it was Cambridge on Boxing Day, was when there was that pinball in the area and we had about three or four shots, close range shots on goal. That was the most exciting thing that has happened on the football pitch this season. And I just don't think that the way it's played now, it just doesn't, you know, you don't get you don't get the ball over the top, the striker running onto it anymore. And the wingers, you don't get just sort of a Joey Beecham style run. You just don't get that kind of play anymore. And the most exciting thing about that Swansea game was Kemal Roofe's goal on the break, because that was That is how you play football. That is what's exciting on a football pitch. Whilst football now is technically brilliant, it's just not as exciting. And I don't think that the fans react to it as well.
It's interesting you say that. The first half at Reading was deathly dull. And I thought at first it's a lack of, you know, tactical nous or, I don't know, energy or something like that. But I think it's deliberate. Whereas the opening, don't really want this to sort of always be, it was better in, back in the day. But the opening period of a game was often about kind of fighting for position. So it was instantly physical and quite chaotic. Football now is all about controlling the game and almost just killing the energy to establish your tactical position. So I think you lose that. And I think the other thing is interesting to say about the kind of the ball over the top. The last few minutes you're chasing the game or you're looking for a winner or whatever. The philosophy nowadays is about making a quality chance. And that means about thinking clearly under pressure, making sure that the ball into the box is a quality ball and all that kind of stuff. In the past, and maybe it was just naivety, is it was about launching it into the box and hoping. And that was in itself really exciting. The last time I remember it happening was that incredible last minute goal against Bradford by Jamie Mackey, which, you know, we'd just run out of time. Tactics went out the window. Josh Ruffles launched the ball to Gavin White and then Mackie came piling in to score in the last minute. And that's old school football. I get, you know, the coaches are going to turn around and go, yeah, but it's technically better and that kind of thing. But I totally agree. That sort of slightly less refined football was more exciting.
It's all very well Manning and Buckingham both saying, well, formations aren't important, blah, blah, blah. But it's just so obvious that is absolute key to what they're doing. It's all about resetting and it's got very technical. And I don't see how that wouldn't impact the excitement levels in the stands. You know, there is no Chris Maguire in our team. It's a two-way street. That's what I'm saying. I agree.
I think there's a lot of chat at the moment at Premier League level as well about the quality of atmosphere in stadiums. An awful lot of that is laid at the door of proper fans, for want of a better phrase, being priced out of the market because it's so damn expensive in the Premier League to buy a ticket now. And the tourists, when they say tourists, what they mean is people who don't look English in the crowd. More broadly, they're talking about the fact that it's people who aren't the hardcore supporters. It's people who just want to come and see Liverpool or Man City or Arsenal play because, you know, they're international tourists and they've heard of them and that's exciting for them. So they're in the stands taking photographs of the opposition manager and stuff like that. And maybe there is part of that, but, you know, these stadiums hold like 70, 80,000 people, the likelihood of, you know, kind of that element of the crowd having that much of an impact on the atmosphere, I think, is pretty low. And I think given that most of the type of football that Liam Mannings and then Des Buckinghams play is not borrowed, it's basically a lift and shift from the Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp model. I don't think it's any surprise that if we're having these issues with atmosphere and the excitement levels of the game, then that's being replicated at the Premier League as well. And I don't know what the answer to
that is. One of the answers that's been muted and been discussed online and is always dismissed as tin pot is a drummer. And to my mind, I mean, we have away fans coming in sort of, you know, tens or, you know, 200 turn up. If there's a drummer, they're just going for it for most of the 90 minutes. They're all singing. They're all behind it. And, I mean, I don't want that bloke with the bell from Portsmouth, obviously. But if someone turned up at the back of the East Stand with a drum, I mean, what would happen? Would it just get, like, ripped off him and shoved on his head or something? I don't know.
I don't think that's where they should suggest they shove the drums.
But I
sideways.
I mean, I'm not a massive fan, but in terms of an atmosphere builder.
Well, if we don't like drums, can we try something else? Has anybody got like a glockenspiel or something that they can bring along?
Some maracas.
Trombone. the answer, or part of the answer, is to get a broader range of people going to the football. If the only people that end up going to football is Oasis fans, they are going to eventually...
Yeah, but 1994's Liam Gallagher has just released a single with 1989's John Squire, so there's life in them yet.
Is that real music?
Proper music for proper football fans.
But it is ultimately about new ideas and putting ideas and ideas that some won't work and stuff like that. And I totally agree about a drum. I get all that, you know, it's kind of funnier or easier to be cynical and dismissive. And you're right, we've had a Burton Albion or someone like that coming to the Kassam and 48 fans and yeah. a drummer.
Yeah.
And they still out and they outsing us. So why wouldn't you try these things? Years ago, I went to an England schoolboy game at Wembley. There was 28,000, 30,000 people there. So potential for just rattling around. And it was England against Brazil. The local Brazilian community in London, clearly this is an opportunity to see their national team that they wouldn't see very often. And they brought samba drums and, you know, all that kind of stuff and played throughout the entire game. Even though the stadium was virtually empty in comparison to the capacity, the atmosphere was fantastic. There's got to be a local Oxford samba group, you know. Could the club just bring them in to give it a go and see what happens?
There was discussion quite a lot of creating a section which is like designated for people who want to get singing and get atmosphere going, because I do understand this perspective, but the club were really reticent to take that idea on board because it would involve upsetting probably a handful of people who had a season ticket in a particular space for a long time. But bearing in mind, this long time we're talking about was probably about 7 or 8 years at this point. You know, this isn't, you know, I have been sat here for 45 year kind of thing. This was relatively new. And that is exactly how all of our fans sound to everybody, including me, to anybody who is not an Oxford United supporter, by the way. But yeah, but there was this going, we don't really want to upset people, don't want to ruffle feathers. And actually, in the grand scheme of things, those people would be pretty miffed. And I'd have been, if that had happened to me, I'd be pretty miffed. But I'd get over it pretty quickly. And if it was, you know, it feels like a small price to pay for having a crack at trying something to improve the atmosphere. But in the grand scheme of things, one thing that will help, and I know it is an excuse because it isn't just about the stadium, but moving out of that stadium will help hugely.
I mean, it seems only fair there's a singing section when given there's a very distinct moaning section at the Kassam Stadium, more commonly known as the South Stand Upper. We have a guy sat in front of us whose negativity is just unparalleled. So I just looked it up. So on October the 3rd, Portsmouth are home to Wickham, and we were beating whoever we were playing. And we were going to go top. Portsmouth beat Wickham in the 98th minute. The guy in front of us was more pleased that Wickham lost than we had an opportunity to go top.
he turned to us and made that point, didn't he?
Yeah. He hated Wickham and Gareth Ainsworth so much, he'd rather they lost than we went top of the league.
And I bet he still denies that it's a derby.
Absolutely, though, absolutely. No, don't call it a derby. I mean, perish the thought that we try and actually market this match so that people want to come and feel excited about it.
I like to call it a derby because it really annoys people.
I mean, by every single definition under the sun, it is a derby. It just is. I'm sorry. It's never going to be fierce like Swindon. Of course it's not. But I tell you what, I was at the Reading game and the Wickham games were a damn sight more ferocious and exciting and atmosphere building than that Reading game, definitely.
Unless you're playing at Wembley in front of nobody. Yeah.
Why did he pass?
Oh, let it go.
Is that true that Akinfenwa was shouted leave it from the stands? And that's why Moore ducked. And because obviously there was no supporters, it could be heard. Is that just a massive conspiracy theory?
I love it.
It does sound like the kind of thing that Akinfenwa himself would make up.
Yeah. I've bought it. I'm all for it. I like him. I like him. Class footballer. I'm pretty sure as well the last time he came on with us, you know, there was that rugby controversy years ago with the fake blood capsules. I'm sure that's what he had on the pitch. That, you know, he came on and within like 30 seconds he was sat down on the ground bleeding. He's the master. Bow down, I say.
And as I said, how can you not find that amazing?
I know. I would love to have seen him play for us. I can't deny it. It would have been a lot of fun just for a season.
Did you see Des Buckingham's interview? Not see it. Listen to Des Buckingham's interview on the Dub. There was a question about how many players do we want to sign in the window, and he said, "Well, we've got Tyler Bury in, which is one, which is good. And Jamie coming in place of James Beadle, that was number two. And Tyler's signed, so that's three. That's not three. So by the same token that signing Edwards is four, and if he's not available until April, that's going to be like a new signing. So that's five.
Did you see the amazing video today of the disability team? I mean, they only started back today, so that's another eight. you know... Oh, it was beautiful though. I must admit, it did choke me up, I have to say.
I absolutely love watching those things. I genuinely do. And I don't want to turn something negative out of it, but I really, really hope somebody takes that and shoves that in the face of all the people who are campaigning against the new stadium, which of course is their right to do so, but campaigning against it by trying to make out that football clubs are not, that football clubs are a force for bad, and shows them those things to genuinely educate them, because of all of the negativity that surrounds a football club. There's so much positive stuff that around football, and I really wish that stuff was more visible to the general public, because I just don't think people know.
Yeah, Andy, I'm waiting for a mark out of 10 for my Goodwin pun. Oh, you might have done it.
I haven't seen it yet. So it's going to be 7 out of 10, just so you know.